Hey everybody, I'm Jeremy and I'll call it.
Hi, Jeremy.
Let's think about who we should bring in to speak tonight, be the first speaker of the year. And I really wanted somebody to be solid, someone that would agree to speak on New Year's Day would be good. And, you know, I was thinking about it and it kept coming back to Kathy. And when I think of Kathy, I just think of someone that's really, really solid in AA. Crazy as a loon, but solid in AA.
Yes.
And that's one of her enduring things. I met her, I think, in 2009, and I'm friends with her husband, John, as well. But I really became friends with Kathy. We just had a lot of insane energy, craziness at the same time. And, you know, I got to know, or at least feel like I knew what she did in the program, and she was very, very active. She was very, very thorough. So there was certainly a time where if someone needed a female sponsor, they post me. I could think of really of one person, they would send them to Kathy. And it's like, stop sending me crazy people, you know. And eventually, you know, through her, I was introduced to my now sponsor. And it didn't go right from the first time I met him to ask him to be my sponsor. It was, Kathy, what do you think about this business problem? She goes, I don't have any experience in that, but call Bob. I'm like, okay. And then about 6 months later, you know, call Bob again. And then a year later, it's like, have you asked Bob to be your sponsor yet? I'm like, I don't know. I mean, you need to just ask him. Just ask him. He'll say yes. So she's been a big influence on me and probably a big influence on the people I work with, and I really appreciate it. We're glad you're here. Thanks.
I had to cringe when he got up here. I thought, oh, God, because I know him so well. And Bob would say, be sure to embarrass her, you know. That was lovely. Thank you. My name's Kathy Shires. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 4th of 2007, so God willing, on Monday I'll have 9 years again. The first time I ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 18 years old, 1989, so clearly have made several mistakes as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I must say that ever since going into treatment and being forced to go to AA meetings, they were odd at first, but it didn't take me long to really fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And even though I haven't stayed sober the whole time, it's been pretty hard for me to really get away because I knew that you guys were my people, you know. At any point, probably up into including today, have never thought I had as worst case of alcoholism as I actually did at that particular time. And so it took me a long time to really, in falling on my face and every time coming back in and doing a little more and a little more and a little more until I finally accepted what should have been the truth from the get-go, which is I either do everything you suggest or I'm just taking up a seat and waiting to relapse again. And I can tell you, it's a lot easier to stay sober than to get sober. It's very painful and humiliating, for sure. Speaking is definitely not my favorite thing to do. But I do know that when I was a newcomer and came to AA, going to speaker meetings was probably my favorite type of meeting. That's not always the case these days. People want to go to discussion meetings and chat about themselves all the time. I like to hear the stories, you know. I like to hear the stories. I like to hear the funny stuff. And it kind of gave me the release of the fear, the self-centered fear of having to share, having to be impressive, you know. Because when I was in discussion meetings, you went around in a circle, I'd already be constructing what I'm going to say as it's like four people away. So I don't hear anything those few people say. Because I think, oh, I am going to get this whole meeting sober. Like, I am just going to turn this whole thing around, right? I'm all up in my head. And Bob talks a lot about being up in that head and thinking, how do I need to sit to look like I know what I'm talking about? You know, and how do I need to inflect? And, I mean, it was all that stuff. And coming to a speaker meeting, I could just breathe, kick back, relax, and listen. But as I said, coming in at 18 years old, I came in, I heard this guy one time say, you know, about your attitude, your approach to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said that he came the same way, which is, you know, you look out over a valley, you know, you're a buzzard and you're looking out over the valley and it's gorgeous. There's waterfalls and gorgeous greenery and the buzzard doesn't see any of that. All they see is the rotten carcass right there, and they go straight for it, right? So I came to AA listening to these stories, laughing at the funny antics and the tragedies that we still laugh at, because we never laugh at anything appropriate, and then, but looking for reasons not to belong, you know? My hope is that at least something that I say will resonate with some of you, you know what I mean? I don't have to be impressive to everybody. I don't think that everybody in this room is going to relate to my experience. Some are going to say I was a lot worse. Some are going to say I never went that far, you know? I had all the excuses in the world, and I think when someone's ready, things will just click, 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 you know? And if you're not ready, nothing's getting in, even if, you know, it could actually later on when you get beaten enough by alcohol. I used to would say, telling my story, you know, this big, sad, sob story about growing up in alcoholism. And that is the truth. My mother was a really bad alcoholic, and I was the only child, and my dad worked 1 to 2 jobs trying to keep our very simple family afloat. But we never had any money. My mother was always stealing the checkbook, writing bad checks for drugs and stuff all over town, having to get messes cleaned up, you know, just the chaos of alcoholism. And I have friends who had parents that drank, and they had parties at their house sometimes, and it looked really fun, and they couldn't wait to get an adult, and it seemed like the cool thing, and they'd sneak some drinks, and or maybe the parents let them have a little bit, and it was like giggle and watch them, you know, like fairly minor. In my case, I saw nothing but degradation of alcoholism. It did not look like something that was to be looked forward to or fun. It looked like horror, you know. My mother was the thing living on the couch that you just kind of tiptoed in, and you put your stuff down and try to tiptoe out again and never be seen. And so I stayed gone a lot from the house. I didn't bring too many people to the house because I never knew what it was going to be like. It was violent. It was crazy. You know, and it was the 1970s, and so I probably wouldn't have been in that house, you know, as long as I was, but it was the 70s. I mean, she had 8 DUIs, including hit a pedestrian when I was in the car, and she never lost her license. You know, things have changed a lot, right? There were many times my dad probably wanted to leave, and he just couldn't. That's not the way that I saw it. Nobody was telling me, being 8, 9, 10 years old, what I thought and telling me the truth. All they would say is, she's very sick. And I thought, well, I don't know about sick, but she's certainly scary, you know. So when they split up, finally she just kind of crossed a line in a very violent episode, and finally he could leave. And I was relieved. I was like, oh, thank God that thing's out of the house. And, you know, I swore up and down that especially once it was just my dad and I, and it was normal, and I saw what some degree of normal living looked like, I thought, you know, you're a total loser if you drink, if you smoke, if you do any of this stuff, because it all was disgusting to me. And my mother ended up dying at 39, you know, a couple of years after the marriage went south. And, I mean, I didn't shed a tear. I was like, it was like a distant aunt had died. Like, somebody like, oh, okay. You know, I'm sitting here thinking, because I've always been very full of self-centered fear. That's probably the earliest emotion I can think of. That and being a total goofball. Okay, so that was kind of the thing. But I couldn't be too much of a goofball as I wanted to, because I had too much self-centered fear of what people thought of me. So I was trying to navigate between these two things, because the truth is I'm absolutely wacky, you know, but I can't be quite that, because then people might not like that. So I'm kind of navigating this, and I just thought, you know, why would you, you know, drink? And I kind of felt like I found some friends, could kind of come out and play a little bit. And then, I don't know what happened exactly. I mean, I turned 15, and we were on a vacation, and my aunt was the only adult there, and the guardian at that time. And I had a few friends, and we all just kind of concocted some plan to get drunk and see what it was like, you know? And they said, you got to talk to your aunt, see if she'll buy it and everything. So she did, and she bought us... We went to the grocery store. She said, as long as you stay in the condo, you know, it'll be okay. I said, all right. So we bought 6 2-liter bottles of coolers between 4, you know, 15, 16-year-olds drinking. I don't even know if they make them in that size anymore. But, you know, we got the strawberry, the cherry. We wanted, like, one of everything to try. And we had a ball, you know. We played, I think one that was with us had drank a couple of times. So he knew about playing quarters, and he knew about playing some other drinking games when you curse. And so, of course, I got drunk really quickly because I can't help but curse all the time. I just don't curse up here. I kind of have a little bit of sense of when to reel it in. But come to my house, and you'll see it fly. That's not one of my spiritual principles, by the way. So, I don't believe in being a lady and being too good here. I might not be any use if I am. So anyway, we all get really drunk. One of my friends ends up vomiting in the bathroom, which we think is hysterical. We're laughing at him. Me and this other dude are standing on the balcony shouting obscenities and throwing things at people at the pool. And my aunt is so mad behind us pouring out what's left, you know, like, oh my God, this is a terrible thing. You know, we were just running amok. And that was the best night I ever had in my whole life up to that point. And I'd had some pretty fun times, really, despite the crazy alcoholism. The good memories I remember mostly are being with friends and staying with their families and stuff like that. But to say that my childhood was all dark and awful and, you know, that's just simply not true. It's a story that my ego made up. Was there a lot of tragedy? Sure. But I've managed to eke out fun here and there. But I had never had fun like that. And the real deal was is that I never grew up with any concept of God whatsoever. We never went to church. I would go to church with my grandmother if I was down South Georgia or something, maybe. But I didn't even know the Lord's Prayer until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew the beginning part because it was in a Yaz song. I knew that part. But I'm a quick study, so by the third meeting, I kind of got it. You know, I kind of mumble like I know what I'm doing, and I'm a quick study. So, but there was no, you know, I had no God in my life. And that night that I drank, I found my higher power in a bottle. I thought, it just changed everything. I remember thinking when I was about 7 years old, I like to tell this little story because to me it was really, I don't know, odd, very poignant. You know, back in the 70s, you could leave your kids in the car and no big deal, go in and shop. And I was in the car and the windows fogged up and you draw on all the windows. And I wrote, I will never be normal. I'm seven. Right? And when my parents came back out, I actually erased it because I knew this was not something somebody needed to see. But I went through life feeling like everybody got the memo but me. You know, I'm just on high alert, having to pay attention to what, you know, people like, dislike, you know, again, quick study. And so then I might bring out whichever Kathy I felt like would fit best there because I'm driven by self-centered fear. I had to be accepted by everybody. And so I looked like I fit in everywhere and felt like I fit in nowhere because the real me wasn't showing up. If somebody did like me and was a good friend, they really liked the figment of my imagination because I didn't really present the real me. And I just walked around thinking that something was missing, and I didn't know what it was. I didn't feel like other people looked. They all look like they know how to do it, how they do life, what's going on. And I didn't, you know. I just became a very good actress. I look like I get what's going on. And the drink set me free. It set me free of all that. I could be the complete goofball that I was. It's completely out there. Anything you said or did was excused because you're drunk, you know. And I realized what had been missing that whole time was alcohol. It was like alcohol deficiency. And I set out from that moment on to get as drunk as I could, as often as I could, which wasn't all the time, but it gained rapid pace really quickly. And that was like spring break, so April. By the summertime, I'm drinking every day. And the party is on, big time. And, you know, all my friends changed. Now it seemed like I was accepted with the cool kids, the party crowd. I knew where the party was, kind of thing. And I felt like Bill Wilson, like I had arrived. I was really important. So silly. But it was the truth. And, you know, I know I couldn't have put it in words then, but Bob actually said this, and I totally get it. He said, you know, it's about that change in perception, right? It's like I could have the weight of the world in my teenage shoulders, whatever that was. You know, I can't get the boy to do right, and this is going to hell, and this kind of thing, and I just, all this stuff, right? And that got increasingly more, increasingly more, increasingly more. And I suffered from depression and wanted to kill myself on a regular basis, just, you know, usually in some epic way, like slice my wrist and sling the blood all over the walls and you'll pay, you'll see, you're going to feel bad. You know, usually something like that, but never any real serious planning, but just kind of wanting to go out in some crazy style and make everybody feel bad. But I could have all that stuff on me and then go to somebody's house where there was drinks and later on some drugs. And it was like all of a sudden I became Scarlett O'Hara. Tomorrow's another day, you know? In fact, the more that I drank, the more brave I became. And let's take a baseball bat to that boyfriend. Let's go find the girl. And if you got a friend that's like, yeah, let's go do it. I mean, it's a game on, right? Most of the time it was just talk, right? But you kind of felt better because you felt like you had a plan in place. And the next day you wake up and you're sober, probably feeling like crap, but you're sober again and it's back on you again. And then some. And nothing's done. Nothing's changed. You know, and you have to do it again. And it was just this thing over and over and over again. And I didn't like a lot of the symptoms of alcohol. I liked the freedom it provided. I certainly liked the feeling. And it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. But that's men and women. Alcoholics don't just like it. They flat out need it. I needed something. I had no idea that I had a spiritual malady. I didn't even believe that for a long time coming into AA meetings, you know. But I had something that demanded to be treated. And I finally found the first solution I had ever found. You know, if alcohol doesn't do that to you to get that kind of change in perception, then it can't do much to you, really. You know, your wiring's probably different than mine. I watch non-alcoholics, you know, all the time thinking, that's so interesting, you know. I love how they leave just a little bit left in their drink. Alcoholics never leave a drop. Unless they're passed out and they just can't get it in their mouth. You know, but they non-alcoholics have that wiring. They start to feel it and they feel like they're losing control. I need to switch to water or toffee or something now because I feel like I'm losing control. And I have exactly the opposite reaction. Things felt out of control in some degree of sobriety. And when as I drink, I feel like I'm getting control. I can take care of that boyfriend and his... I can take care of that girl. I can take... You know, I'm getting control now. I can think straight, which is crazy, right? But it's an illusion. And I buy that lie. And, you know, But I didn't like some of the symptoms. That was great, but I always overshot the mark. I drink with a degree of quickness. I like funneling particularly. That was kind of fun. I don't know too many non-alcoholics that funnel. I mean, maybe when they're young and it's kind of the thing you do, but I drink with quickness. And so I projectile vomited on a regular basis. I was a girl who had to deal with the room spinning all the time. I'm the girl that didn't know who in the end would show up, whether I'd be your best friend, your best bud, or I'd want to chase you with a knife. You know, it was out of control. And my dad was starting to get calls about coming to take care of me, you know, because I always decided I wanted to drive somewhere. You know, it just, they had to take care of me crying, and it was just a mess. And my aunt had enough. She was kind of my guardian for a couple of years there because my dad had moved to Cartersville. He had started dating his high school sweetheart and got remarried. And I had to go up to Cartersville. Now, this is bad news because I have white hair. I'm talking white hair like this. And it stood straight up on my head, and I wore nothing but black and would have been, like, totally goth or emo, you know, if that was in at the time. But, you know, lots of long crosses and things like that. And that was not really the norm up there. It was a little more accepted in Atlanta than it was in Cartersville. And the only people I knew were some folks that I had kind of, you know, played with when we were like 10, 11 years old, and they all were in drugs. And my alcoholism demands to be treated. And I could have gone through the tedious process of trying to stand outside the 7-Eleven, get somebody to buy it over and over and over again, but that gets old. For somebody young, getting drugs is like easy, real easy. And so I slid into that whole arena. And, you know, just because I did drugs doesn't mean I'm not an alcoholic. It just intensified, enhanced everything, and it just gets all mixed up together. But when I come to AA, I'm not sure what I am. Am I a drug addict? Am I an alcoholic? You know? And it was a little hard to decipher. And so I guess it was a good thing that I relapsed that first time after a few years, because all I did was drink and it solidified, even though it didn't get nearly as bad as some people's stories, but it was enough for me. And so I, you know, I did just about any drug that I could get my hands on, except a few, but I guarantee you if I had been drunk or high enough, I would have done that too. Because I just kept erasing the line, you know, because when I'm drinking, you know, people try to get me to smoke pot, and I don't know about that, and then one time I did it, and then the cops got called at the party, and there was a helicopter above, and, you know, all this kind of stuff, and, but, you know, I'll erase that line, and then I draw it at cocaine, and then you try that, erase that, and then it's acid, and erase that, and, I mean, it's just redraw it, and I was sort of a equal opportunity drug user. And the truth is, I'm anything all the time, gal. And it was kind of good news to know when you did a lot of speed, you could drink and not projectile vomit anymore. That was a real bonus. So where it got right before I came into AA the first time is that there's a line in the book in the fifth step that talks about the alcoholics like to live a double life. You know, they present their stage character, they like their fellows to see, but they know in their hearts they don't deserve it. I've already told you that was already a piece of business even when I was younger. It became even more a piece of business as I got into the CD drug world and doing all this kind of stuff. And so what it looked like was I go to high school and I'm in all the smart classes and I make straight A's and I graduate with pins and cords around my neck. And my loser friends that had all dropped out of school, and some of them were the sons of truck drivers, and, you know, they were all out there cheering me on. And I thought, not a problem, right? Because I saw the commercials. Is your child failing out of school? Is your child getting in, you know, altercations? And is your child, you know, and the more deeper I got into drugs and alcohol, the more normal I looked. You know, the white hair calmed down. Everything started looking, because I had to present a stage character to you, you know. But it was a big lie. And but I fell into, you know, when you have a habit like mine, and I've kind of got a man-sized habit, you fall into a lot with a lot of drug dealers, because you know, then you get supplied. Because I tried dealing them myself, and that, I mean, I always did all the profit, and then some of the regular stuff, too, and then had to run around trying to figure out how to pay them back for the stuff, and I was terrible at it. And so I hung out with these drug dealers, and we were just talking about this last night at my husband and I's New Year's Eve party. I loved going to clubs, and I've been going to clubs since I was 14, before I ever drank. I loved dancing, loved music, and there was a club in Atlanta called Club Rio. No Club Rio? Best place on the planet. I remember it was Halloween 1988, and I went to the Rod Stewart concert at the Omni and was going to meet some friends outside the club. And I had never been to an over 21 club at that point. And she said, oh, it'll be no problem, get you in. And she just gave me, she got her hand stamped, she gave me her ID, and I looked nothing like this girl, and I just got right in. And it was Halloween, there were all these costumes, and the next thing you know, somebody gives me a hit of ecstasy. And I thought I had died and gone to heaven. I thought, I want to live here. This is where I want to be all the time. And we were talking about that last night. It's a funny thing about that, is that on that day, at that moment, you know, the way that I feel has very little to do with staying sober. In fact, it's a huge detriment. Huge, you know. I'm constantly taking my emotional pulse. How do I feel now? Well, how do I feel now? Well, not good. How do I feel now? Well, you know, None of that matters at all. It only matters what you do. And here's a good indication. It's on that night, if you had said, Kathy, how are you doing? Which I don't even hear how you doing. I hear how are you feeling. I respond with how I feel, right? So they say, how are you doing? Excellent. Oh, my God. This is the most amazing. Yeah, I am doing so well. If you'd ask my family, how's she doing? We're not really sure where she is. We don't know who she's with. I'd gotten to where, you know, I tried to stick to the rules. My dad was pretty strict, but it was hard to do. And they would say, we hope that she'll get it together. She has so much potential. There was meetings about my potential a lot and how I wasn't meeting up to it, you know. Because people I was in school with were going to Ivy League schools or becoming doctors and lawyers and whatever, and I just thought, I'll go to the University of Georgia and party like them, because I've been to some great parties in Athens. I mean, like, the whole goal, everything changed, right? And then the whole thing about the feeling, you know, last year when my dad died, somebody might say, how are you doing? Well, not really great. You know, I miss my dad. It was really sad, and I hated that he had to go through that cancer and whatever, you know. I don't know. I'm not doing good. And then if you ask my sponsor, how's she doing? She's doing great. She's sad, but she's taking her sponsee phone calls. She's still meeting with them to go through the big book. She's making her commitments. She's, you know, not turning off her phone and, you know, going into a hole. She's doing great. You know, so how I'm feeling is not necessarily a good indication of how I'm doing. Because I was hung out with drug dealers and I was, you know, the idea of even going to University of Georgia got changed because I got two speeding tickets and also hit three cars, a tree, a ditch, and a MARTA bus. Because I drove high all the time. You know, I didn't get tickets for all those different things, but I had a knack for running into things. I got out of the MARTA bus one, though. We're really crafty, aren't we? You know, and what's really funny about those car accidents, a couple of them were pretty bad. And it's a little irritating sometimes when I hear people say, well, God was with me all the time. Well, what happened if I died in that accident? So God wasn't with me then? I don't think God had anything to do with any of that. I think he's just looking, you know, if God is a person at all, looking at me going, really? You know? I mean, I got nothing. You know, you're just running amok, you know? Maybe one day. But I end up going to Georgia Southern because I was not going to have a car, and my grandmother enticed me down there. She lived in Statesboro, and she enticed me with a condo. You can buy me, clearly. I have no morals. So I went there, and I thought, I can't go without a stash or something, you know. That, no way. And so I went in on a pretty big buy of some ecstasy, and we got arrested by the DEA. And my car was seized, my bank account was frozen, everything I could have lost at that time. And I got a little bit of my mother's Social Security because I just turned 18. Lovely. And I'm having drug tests, and that was like the worst 6 months of my life, because my favorite thing to do in the world. Some people, you know, got to where they just would drink and use at home, and not me. I mean, first thing I drink and use, I want to go out in public, you know, anywhere, just anywhere at all, you know. Trip on acid, let's go to 7-Eleven because it's really lights in there, and I mean, we're just out all the time. That was the weirdest thing about being sober. It's like, how do you go to a movie sober? I didn't even do that. I mean, you know, I'm like, shh, popping the beer in there, you know? How do you do anything at all? Because life was so boring. People are so dull. And I liked excitement. I want to, you know, I used to tell people, when you go out with me and, like, my friend Amy and, you know, you never knew what was going to happen, but you knew there'd be a story. I liked having a story to tell at the end, you know? And the people we met, things we did, and all that stuff. But so I went in on that buy, and those next 6 months, that's when I became the crazy paranoid person, because I thought my phones were tapped, looking out the windows, thinking they're looking on me. It was awful. But you know, I thought if you had my life, you'd drink and use too. And I tried just to drink. You know, I was not legal to drink, but the idea of being sober was no way. You know, no way. And so I went down to Southern, and, I mean, we have an amazing radar for us, right? You know, I can go down with really good intentions, and within 2 seconds, I got a hookup for this and that and all this kind of stuff, and it's game on again. And so I start, you know, trying to beat the tests, and I beat a few, and then you get cocky. And, you know, I have a couple that turn up positive, and the judge wants to talk to me. And again, I'm paranoid. That's secret code for get you in here so I can lock you up right now. And I, you know, so I got this terrible fear. He wants to see me, like, on Friday. And then I've got the boyfriend that won't do right. And I, this is the guy that I thought was my soulmate. I mean, it was so sick. I would turn my will and life over to this person, you know. And I wanted to put my claws in him so he'd do the same thing with me. We were so sick. And I couldn't get him to do right. And I just thought, you know, this is the day. This is, I want out. I can't deal with this anymore. And for some reason, sitting home at my dad's house, because I was on Christmas break from college, and I decided to call Peachford. It was like Charter, and they had a lot of locations at that time, and they actually had a little satellite office with a therapist in Cartersville. So I guess if you went to the hospital, you could continue on with a therapist there. But I got one of my stepsisters to take me over to that little office in Cartersville, and I just practically vomited all over this guy. Oh my God, my mother this, and oh my God, this kind of thing, and oh my God, you know, it was just like, blah, 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 blah. I had never been to a therapist, never anything, and was running around so crazy, and I just, blah, and he didn't say, okay, time's up. I mean, he just let me just rant on and on and on and on, and at the end of this long rant, I wish I had a copy of that. If it was a tape of it, it'd be epic. And he said, you need hospitalization, like, right now. And, of course, my dad would never pay for something like that. But because I was so crazy, they worked it out. So I could go to Peachford on just what the insurance would pay. And I didn't have to pay a dime because they said, this girl, I mean, she's right on the edge, you know. And I went to Peachford. And because I was so depressed and so crazy, instead of putting me on the alcohol and drug unit, they put me on the dual diagnosis unit. So I'm extra special kind of alcoholic, right? And so they diagnosed me with clinical depression. And, you know, I've been diagnosed with clinical depression, bipolar, manic depression, depending on what the flavor of the month was in psychiatry. And I look like all that, I promise you. I look like all that on a bad spiritual hair day. You know, and I'm not going to tell you what your deal is because that's your deal. But for me, all it's ever been is really bad alcoholism. I have, instead of clinical depression, I have clinical self-centeredness, clinical self-involvement, you know. And when my life is all about me and my emotions and what's going on with me and what you have to do with me, I'm depressed like that. It is like somebody took the oxygen hose that goes to my spirit and put a crimp in it like a garden hose. And I'm suffocating, full of self, you know. I mean, even today, if I'm left 30 minutes to sit there and ponder my life, I don't come away happy. I come away with some new problem that needs attention immediately. You know, my husband's not loving me enough. He didn't have the right job. He needs to get a different job so he have more money. This kind of thing, blah, 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 you know, whatever it is. I seem to be really happy when I'm just not thinking about me at all. And me's taken care of just fine without me having to examine it. But I go to Peachford, and then they, you know, I stayed there for 30 days, and, you know, they put you through all these back, and this is late 80s, right? So this is like the normal 30-day stay, you know? Now it's like detox 6, 4, 7 days, and you're out of there mostly. But we went to art therapy and music therapy and primal screamed and all kinds of meditation things and all this stuff. And then they had to go to those pesky AA meetings. And I thought, ugh, I just roll my eyes like, you don't understand. I'm so complex and I need a team of doctors looking after me. And, you know, I can express myself in this, you know, art therapy, drawing pictures of fire because I'm so mad. And, you know, I mean, it was just so crazy. Oh, my God. And I just didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I can remember using the payphone from the hospital, calling that crazy boyfriend that won't do right, you know, because I can't let him go. And I'm saying, well, it's not like I'm going to stay sober. And thank God, because he drank toe-to-toe with me, did drugs toe-to-toe with me. And thank God he said, just do whatever they say. You know? And I still was just like, they started talking about a halfway house. And I thought, I'm sorry, you've locked me up for 30 days and, I got to get back to school, got to get back to my life, gotta. And then my lawyer called me on the phone and they put it through to me. And she said, well, they're not trying to get you for the 100 tabs of ecstasy you were buying. They're trying to get you for the whole 4,000. And I said, what was that halfway house you were talking about? Because I'm no dummy, I'm no dummy. I thought, stay in treatment or go to jail, whatever. I got to do whatever looks good. And alcoholics do this all the time, right? Playing one step ahead of the game, always. And so I go to a long-term treatment facility down in Statesboro. And I thought it was like a halfway house. It wasn't. It was locked up longer. No talking to men. You weren't even able to have a sponsor. I mean, you had a counselor who was in AA. That's the person you did your steps with and whatever. And they were trying to work really hard for me not to go to jail, and didn't work out that way. But I at least had enough time. They extended it a few times that I was able to start going through some of the steps. And I was in the middle of writing my 4-column resentment inventory, and I had 150 resentments. I mean, I was just riddled with them. And when I ended up having to go to prison, and I went to prison for 6 months in a federal penitentiary in Lexington, Kentucky for that. And part of that was because the judge said, look, I know that you wanted to do her commitment there. He said, but there's no fence around that place, and she is an asshole. Entitled. I was a victim. Nothing was ever my fault. I came to AA with no guilt for anything I had ever done. Some say sociopath. I say that I can hide behind your bad behavior. Because I'd say, well, I wouldn't have acted like that if you hadn't have done this. I always had an excuse. And if I ever couldn't really get an excuse, well, it's because I had a shitty childhood. If you came 3 steps behind like I did, you need to give me some extra concession. So, it's a story my ego made up. I grew a conscience as I grew a relationship with a higher power here. And the guilt began to come when I could actually put myself in someone else's shoes. But I didn't have the ability back then to even see it that way. And I guess I had fallen in love with AA. We had gone to all these meetings. I had made some friends in that place, some that I'm still friends with today. I found a connectedness in AA with you people, And so I remember being in jail, in prison, and the only thing of real note there was that, one thing was they had homemade alcohol. They fermented the stuff in the walls and would have hooch, and I thought, nobody will ever know. You could drink this and still, you're in Kentucky. It doesn't count in a different state, does it? And then you can go back to Statesboro and you can get your 1-year chip and do cartwheels down the aisle and everybody give you all the praise and all the, because the meetings down there when you got your chip was sort of like the Oscars, and, oh, it's so, thank you so much, that kind of thing, just ego feeding. But the minute that I thought no one would ever know, immediately, it's like a devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other. And that angel said, but you would know. And what if those AA people are right? And the only way you're ever going to be happy, which is all I ever wanted. My list was short of what I wanted from AA. Just to be happy. And really, the truth is, that's not what's on offer. It's a joyful, contented, useful life. Happiness is fleeting, But you can be contented all the time. Really. So I thought, maybe they're right, and I refused. And that was really the first time I really made a change for AA, I think. And I guess the other thing was, and this came later when I made my amends, was that my dad drove me all the way from South Georgia all the way to Lexington. And I never once thought about what was going through that man's mind. I was 18 years old, 105 pounds, tiny little thing, his only daughter, going to this big prison on the hill, looked really scary. Never once thought about that man. All I thought was, I'm going to be raped. I'm going to be beaten. I'm going to be this kind of thing. I'll never survive. All I could do was talk about myself the whole time. And he had to drop me off, wave goodbye, and drive that long drive back. You know? And again, didn't feel any guilt. Didn't. People were like shadows. I didn't even see you. You know, alcoholics are all sensitive when we get sober, right? But we're not sensitive to your feelings. But we're highly sensitive to our own. You can barely say anything around us and we get, oh, that hurt my feelings. You know what I mean? It's a defect, believe me. Because when you get through the steps, that calms down. You're like, okay. You know, thank God I was able to see that for what it was later and could make amends for that specifically. Like, I can't imagine. And that became even more true when I had children. I thought, oh my God, how would it feel for me to drop off one of my kids at a place like that and have to turn around and leave them there? Oh my God, I would cry the whole way home. I'd be worried sick, you know? Never thought about it at all. So I get out and I do the cartwheel down the aisle thing. And I was sober for a year. And I stayed sober that time for 4 years. And I think that I had, you know, kind of a pink cloud, really, when I got out of jail. I mean, I could use real silverware. And I was going to meetings again, and I was, you know, with friends, and I fell in love with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I made a lot of friends. And clearly, I like fellowship. Anybody who was at my house last night know I like fellowship. I like to have fun in sobriety. I think the people that aren't having fun probably aren't going to stay. You know, we're kind of fun-loving people, you know. But I went to barbecues, did all this kind of stuff, and I went to meetings. And I had a sponsor in name only, so if you asked me, I could say, oh, well, Jean is my sponsor. But only time I ever talked to Jean was when I saw her at a meeting, and I would usually tell her about what happened 3 days ago and how I worked it out, in case she needed that information to help somebody, you see. I never picked up the phone to call her. Nothing. Everything was in the scroll, the news feed. It wasn't in real time, you know, nothing. She couldn't help me. And the truth is, I don't think I picked her because I thought she doesn't work the steps. I was going to meetings where it didn't seem like anybody was doing that, really. They used the meeting as their only means of therapy or staying sober. And they came and talked about their day. People would talk about, oh, yeah, I've had that. I prayed this. And you go, okay. It's like you get all the answer there, and that's all you do. And that was just the accepted thing. So I didn't have a sponsor that was saying, when are we going to get together and do the steps? When are we going to get together and read? When are we, you know, I didn't have that. I didn't know people actually did it. Had no idea. And I've asked other people that got sober when I did around the same time. They said, nobody I knew was doing that. And I got a little boyfriend, so that was good. And even when that boyfriend, we broke up or whatever, I would make decisions on where I went to meetings by if the cute guy's car was in the parking lot, you know. Mm-hmm. I kind of took AA like a cafeteria line. You know, you take the yummy bread and butter and take maybe some mashed potatoes and you take the dessert and you leave all the other stuff on the line. So I took a man from the meeting and a cup of coffee from the meeting and, you know, whatever. And I would chair meetings and God share on God knows what. And again, I'm a quick study, right? I would avoid big book meetings like the plague because that's fuddy-duddy and, you know, I don't know. Who wants to read that anyway? So I'd go to step meetings, and we would talk about the steps. You'd talk about what you thought about step 9, you know. And it's kind of like you worked it if you just talked about it for an hour, right? I mean, that's what I thought, you know. And if you go to enough meetings, you can go to a 10 o'clock meeting and hear something that, you know, Jerry said, and it was really profound. And then you go to the 5:30 and you share it like it's your own, you know. I mean, you develop, again, double life. You develop this AA personality, and you can look like you know what you're talking about and be full of crap, totally. And so that ran out. Between year 3 and 4, the depression came back, all the stuff came back, that shine of new sobriety wore off. I'm beginning to go to meetings thinking, is this all there is to sobriety? I hate these people, you know? But I like to time travel, and I can do it standing right here. It's amazing, you know, and the time traveling is a creation of the ego, and it does this. It either pulls me in back this way into the past with resentment, and I'm thinking about what that girl said, and just going to think, I wish I'd said this, it's just keeping me up at night, or I look back with remorse. God, if I'd only done this that time instead of that, you know, and then, all right, go to the future, and everything coming at me looks scary. I'm like Chicken Little, right? The sky's going to fall on me at any minute, or I'll be happy when. So I'm feeling depressed, and I think if I can just get out of South Georgia, if I can go back to Atlanta, if I can get a job, and I wasn't sure I could get a job with two felonies and, like, you know, all the stuff, and I got all that, you know? And let me tell you, what's wrong with me was not caused by my past. It was not caused by out here. It is something inside of me. And it also can't be fixed by getting all your ducks in a row. If I just had the house and the thing and the that and the that. In fact, most people that get that either drink again if they're not working a program or put a bullet in the brain because they think, I have all the elements of being happy and okay, and I'm not okay. The problem is inside. And so when I was on this plane flight for training for the business, they sat me in first class, and the lady next to me ordered rum and Coke, and I ordered a Coke with that little tiny ball of rum was talking to me. And I'd been around alcohol plenty. I'd gone to dance clubs sober. I mean, AA never took anything away from me, really. I was able to do the same things, but with sober people and not be affected, it was totally fine. But that had stopped happening. I wasn't safe and protected anymore. And so when the lady came back by, I said, you have any wine? She said, I have Chardonnay. I said, I'll have one. And I just drank for a few months, and it got increasingly bad very, very fast. And the only reason I didn't pick up drugs is, A, it didn't go on long enough, and I had the threat of 5 years going back to prison. Because if I hadn't had that, it would have been game on. Full balls to the wall. I know, because that's how I am. But I came back in, and that was in, when was it? Yeah, 1994. At that time, some things changed. I thought, what happened? Because you picked up a four-year chip at NABA, and then a few months later, you're picking up a white chip, crying through the whole meeting, feeling like this big. And I thought, well, again, I'm not stupid. Like, you never really had a sponsor you use. I don't even know what you do with a sponsor, really. You certainly never went to big book meetings. You could have hit $1 million check in there from me, and I had never found it. It had dust on it, for sure. And I knew that I never found this higher power. And I'd heard the steps read a lot. And the steps at step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of all of the previous 11 things, including some stuff you're doing in 12, you'll have this spiritual awakening. And I came in really atheist, and I kind of grew to agnosticism after a minute because I couldn't discount what I saw in people's eyes, but I still didn't know how to have that myself. And I would pray when things got really bad, and then as soon as the storm went away, I didn't think about God at all. So I'm just using God as the pinch league, the Bush League pinch hitter, as the 12 and 12 says. And so I had no relationship there. And so I wasn't safe and protected, you know. And so I started to do all those things. And so for the first time, I had a sponsor. She took me through the big book. We worked the steps exactly as it's outlined in the big book. I argued with her a lot. I was not easy to sponsor. I said, why do I have to do that? You know, because to me, I didn't want to do anything if it didn't make sense to me. You know, if I thought it was stupid or, you know, whatever. Finally, she just got to where she said, because I said so. You know, that was what she said every time, because I said so. And I'm, okay. Gosh, she's so stupid. You know, but I would do it. And, I mean, you could do it with grace or you can do it kicking and screaming. As long as you do it, it doesn't seem to matter, really. Because I got over myself eventually. And I had a psychic change. Miracle. And I became a student of the big book. In fact, I probably became one of those annoying big book thumpers that was probably not very effective because I wanted to hit you over the head with it all the time. Tell you weren't doing AA right, you know. But life was really good. And I finally got some sponsees. Nobody asked me to sponsor them those for 4 years. I wonder why. And I met a guy who was in AA, and we got married, and we moved a few times. I went to Connecticut. I went to London. Built a really amazing life. In fact, a life that I never would have thought I wanted. It was not something that, you know, I thought all marriages ended in divorce, and next May I'll be married 20 years. And we got into a relationship when I was kind of early in sobriety. That meant I had to work doubly hard because my sponsor thought, well, she'll never stay sober now. And I thought, the heck you say? I love when somebody threatens me like that. That just gives me more impetus to be like, I'll show you. Doesn't matter why. Has no bearing on the matter. But every time I moved, you know, you probably heard this, especially if you've moved here. If they say, well, you know, I can't sponsor you anymore. You got to get a sponsor in the new place. Well, that's not exactly true. I mean, for a newcomer, of course it's nice to have a sponsor in your home group. You see them a lot and all that kind of stuff. It's great. But every time I moved, trying to find another sponsor, it was like it wasn't as good as the first sponsor. And, you know, the meetings aren't as good here and blah, blah, blah. And, man, by the time I'm in London, you know, I mean, even my husband could say I couldn't even think of anybody who could sponsor her. But I would have been better being sponsored long distance from the States than sponsored by an idiot, which is what happened. I got my own alcoholic mind to bounce this off of. And boy, is this bad. Because I'm right all the time, by the way. I got nobody telling me that I'm wrong. These boys drive me crazy. My husband's driving me crazy. I feel like a martyr all the time. Why do I have to do everything? Everything seemed an imposition. And I am just becoming, you know, I had psychic change, but I am psychic changing back to what I was and some ugly monster over here that I don't like at all. My husband's coming home from work all day, you know, working all day. Because I was a stay-at-home mom. He's touching the door to feel the temperature. What is he walking into? And this is 7, 8 years sobriety, guys, right? I was suffering from untreated alcoholism so bad, I wanted to kill somebody. And I knew that AA worked. I prayed. But there ain't no prayer getting through if that ego is just rampant. Because I really do believe that the God is deep down within me, and the ego lives here. And if that ego, there's too much ego here, I can pray till the cows come home, and ain't nothing happening because I'm standing in the way. And I don't even know how I'm standing in the way. I'm standing in the way because I'm so right about everything. And everything pisses me off, you know. I thought if I could just get back to the States, everything would be fine. But I've been running the show for so long, complaining, that it was like, I mean, I would have had to start over as a newcomer, which I've seen people do with a lot of time. And I had too much ego to do it, I guess. And so, you know, I sort of had a sponsor I kind of worked with, but I wasn't really telling her the real truth. I was playing a double life. I had dishonesty going on. It was a mess. And so the last honest chip I picked up was 10 years. And then my grandmother, my third child was born, and she'd had a stroke in the womb. And I'm not even blaming God for it because I don't have that kind of belief in God, that God's blessing me and cursing me and all that kind of stuff. But I kind of thought it made sense, really, because I've been an awful mother to those boys. So this is kind of what I deserve, really, you know? And I feel so awful. And at the same time, my grandmother that was like my mom had gotten sick. So when I get out of the hospital with my daughter, we go down to visit her. And that started a long process till she died 18 months later. But she had pills in the house, you know. And I don't know why people keep those around. I guess for a thief like me to steal them from you. And I never had a pill problem before, but I promise you, I will use anything. If it says make you drowsy, perfect. Doesn't matter what it is, right? And so I popped a couple, kicked back, watched TV. The world didn't open up. Nobody found out, and I swept it under the rug. And I opened a door. And it didn't start going right then, but I promise you, within a year and a half to 2 years later, in that span of time, I was using 25 a day, round the clock, right? I was, you know, adding something to sleep at night because I'd be so hyped up on painkillers that I could, you know, clean the bathroom with a toothbrush. So I'd have to get something to sleep at night. And then I thought, well, add a diet pill in the morning for a little extra pep, you know. I mean, total management, right? And it was just this crazy thing. Married to somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous, chairperson of my home group, sponsoring people, taking them through the big book, speaking from podiums, high as a kite. Nobody knew. I picked up year 11, year 12, nobody knew. You know, and I was about to pick up year 13. And I remember You know, everybody always, whether you jump through that little sliver of window when you have a moment of clarity, we have a lot of these moments of clarity, but we don't often, you know, go to sleep the next day. It's like, oh, I don't know what I was thinking last night. You know, I was making a real big deal out of nothing then. But I got this moment of clarity that thought, I believe that step zero, Bill talks about in the book, and he says, we've come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as being limited. And I kept thinking, if you're using 25 these a day, what does it look like in the year? Is it 40 a day? What about 5 years? You know? You got to get sober. I'm tired. You know? And the relief that I got from those had kind of worn itself out. You know? John and I were starting to argue, and we never argue. And I, you know, I was getting crazy. So I sit him down and I tell him, you know, I remember I came up with a ruse that I was going to, because I knew I was going to withdraw pretty bad. And I thought, I'll just tell him I have the flu and that I'm going to quit drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. Everybody, because I'm always playing a game, right? And that was the plan. So I had to throw the flu in, you know, afterwards. But it's quit drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. And I was chain smoking because I was taking all these drugs. And he comes home a little early thinking she might be on edge. And I'm in the bath with the first bit of withdrawal, the aches. And I remember this thing this one woman at a speaker meeting in London had said a long time ago. She said, you know, it's the only thing I remember. She said, sometimes you can't save your ass and your face at the same time. And the truth is, if I had been able to get through that ruse, that dishonesty, and pick up year 13, it was only a matter of time before I'd be back at it again. Because you can't build a foundation on a lie. And so I sat him down and told him, and all of a sudden a lot of things made sense for him. And that started what will be, hopefully on Monday, 9 years again. And no pink cloud anymore, by the way. I had to crawl out of the hole day by day, feeling like crap, withdrawing in the meetings, feeling like there's bugs under my skin, months and months of being plunged into depressions, in and out. It was about a year before I started feeling okay again, you know. And I kept thinking, I told my sponsor, okay, I got a sponsor I was actually using, I still use today. And I kind of thinking, I'm in one of those depressions. I'm like, you know, my mother was like, you know, kind of schizophrenic as well as alcoholic and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, maybe I really do have depression and that needs to be treated. And she goes, stop trying to solve your spiritual problem with something in the human realm. You have the experience of being fine without that stuff. Just sit it out. And I did. I wanted it to go away quickly, and it didn't. And it wasn't a matter of, it was really a matter of doing the same things I had learned the last time, but doing them all the time, and then some. You know? I don't think anybody ever told me you can only sponsor like 3 or 4 people at a time. I know that a lot of people tell people that. I have awful sponsors that don't say that. But, you know, the lines in the sand that I drew, like, well, I have kids, so I can't do this. Or, you know, there's always, I could use it to my advantage. And all that went away. AA had to be the most important thing all the time. I mean, if my wedding anniversary falls on a meeting night, I'm at my home group. We celebrate the day before or after. If it's my kid's birthday on a meeting night, we're at the meeting. We'll celebrate the day before or after. It is the most important thing. I am the girl who always drinks again. And I drank again, sponsoring people, going to AA. Usually people say, well, I stopped going to meetings and, you know. No, I was doing a lot of stuff. The service probably kept me sober a little longer than most. But I have to do it all. I finally got on board with just do it all, just get on with it, quit moaning about it, and just do it. And so I got back to a place of having a psychic change. And, you know, most of the time I am pretty comfortable. And that's a big deal. You know, I can be comfortable with a lot of people. And I can be comfortable going to the movies all by myself. Love it. Prefer it sometimes, really. Comfortable. And I don't notice that I don't that I feel weird, or, you know, going out in the real world thinking there's all of you and then there's me, you know, that's how I always thought, right? And I can go out there as long as I've got doing my commitments and, you know, praying regularly and working the steps, and that's a real living, breathing thing, that my life is in that. As long as I'm doing all that stuff, I can go out there and seem pretty normal. I look normal and pretty much feel normal. You know, every once in a while, my ego jumps all over me, and then I get that same thing where there's all of you, and then there's me, and I'm the weird girl, right? But it's so fleeting. It's like a day, a moment. It just isn't, I live like that day after day. And that was not something that I thought was really on offer here. I mean, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I will never, ever be able to repay the debt that I owe. And I hope I always, as Bob says, I hope I always look like somebody who owes, because I owe big time. And thanks for letting me share. Hopefully, whatever.